out is of daily life. That day catches you by surprise. And that's the state of many Catholics today. They rarely think of the Last Judgment. Don't be like that. Wake up. It's coming. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Weekdays at noon, it's More to Life.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. Each weekday on More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My next guest is a bishop, and this particular bishop has been a friend and accomplice and supporter of some of my work for many years, and I'm very, very glad to have him on the show, Bishop René Henri Gracida. You may know, the listeners may know, that Bishop Gracida was Bishop of Corpus Christi, Texas for many years. But prior to that, he was the first bishop of Pensacola, Tallahassee, before moving on to the Diocese of Corpus Christi in 1983. He was made a bishop originally in Miami. He's auxiliary bishop there in 1971. Born in New Orleans, he was born to Enrique Gracida Corazosa. Hope I got that right. An architect and engineer who was born in Mexico. His mother's name was Mathilde Derbis. I'm sure I didn't get that right because she's French-American. He served as a tail gunner in World War II and participated in the bombing of Dresden, but regretted it later on, and we'll talk about that. Bishop Gracida attended Rice, University of Fribourg, very prestigious school in Switzerland, and the University of Houston, where he got his degree in architecture, which came in handy later on, and he attended St. Vincent College and St. Vincent Seminary in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. Bishop Gracida, it's great to have you on Church and Culture.
Thank you, Dale. It's my pleasure to join you.
I must say, I just finished your recent book, which we want to talk about, entitled An Ordinary's Not-So-Ordinary Life. Oh, my Lord, that's an absolutely perfect title, because this book really rocks. I mean, it really tells the inside story of what it's like to be a bishop. Do you realize how unusual this book is for the autobiography or memoir of a Catholic bishop?
Yes, I do. And that's why I hesitated so many years to write it. I only wrote it because so many of my friends insisted that I write it while I still had a chance, because I'm 91 years old, going on 92. And so they said, you know, Bishop, you're not going to be with us much longer, and you really owe it to us to write your autobiography. So finally, I gave in to them. And if it's an easy read, it's because I wrote it so easily. Let me just say that I decided to write it towards the end of August of 2014, and I sat down at my computer, and I wrote a chapter a day for 26 days. And so I wrote the book in 26 days and didn't go back and change anything in it. And so it was total stream of consciousness, absolute, depending upon recollection, and unedited. I had an editor who looked for typos, but the editor didn't change anything in the text. So the autobiography is a very personal, extemporaneous recounting of the extraordinary events in my life. And if it makes for an easy read, that's the reason.
Well, it is an easy read. I read it in one day preparing for this interview, and it does read as if you were sitting across and telling the story of your remarkable life. And I must say the thing that will jump out to anyone who reads it, and I strongly recommend that listeners do read it, it is available on Amazon. It's entitled An Ordinary's Not-So-Ordinary Life, The Most Reverend Bishop Grassetta's Autobiography, 217 pages. And I read it in maybe 3 hours. It's a life filled with conflict, Bishop. I think we just should get that out in the open. It's much about a series of conflicts that you experienced as a priest, first with the Benedictines, and then a parish priest or diocesan priest, and then as a bishop, especially once you arrived in Corpus Christi. I don't know where you want to start, but I just want to ask you a general question, and that is, when you entered on the road to the priesthood, did you expect your life in the church would be so turbulent?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I was an architect in Houston, practicing architecture, and I began to ask the question, is this what life is all about? Am I supposed to do this for the rest of my life? And finally, I arrived at the conclusion, after making a pilgrimage and a retreat in Rome and visiting during the holy year of 1955, I guess. No, it was a little later than that, 1950. But after making the retreat and the pilgrimage to Rome in 1950, in which I prayed at the tombs of the apostles for guidance in discerning my ultimate vocation in life, I decided that it was to the religious life and to the Benedictine life in a Benedictine monastery. But before we get into the details of my life, let me just preface my remarks with reference to something you said a few moments ago. The book is a continuous series of tumultuous experiences, because that was my life.
And yes.
Well, the reason I wrote the book, besides the pressure being put on me by my many friends, was because I came to realize that my life story had value for the ordinary Catholic in the pew, the ordinary man in the street, or man or woman in the street.
Yes.
Because every life is full from time to time with real difficulties. When a person's very soul is tested, chances with which one is suddenly confronted. And the fact that I survived all of those difficulties in my life by God's grace encouraged me to write the book to encourage others to trust in God's providence, to be obedient to His will as they're able to discern it, and to trust that in the long run, God will write straight with crooked lines.
Yes.
As I said over and over again in the book.
Well, yours got pretty crooked.
Well, it was crooked. There's no doubt about that. So back to your question. What was it?
My question was, when you entered into this journey, or you began this journey towards the priesthood, did you expect the road would be as rocky as it turned out to be?
On the contrary, in choosing a vocation as a Benedictine monk at St. Vincent Arch Abbey in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, I thought I was choosing a life of solitude and of contemplation.
Because, I have to laugh because I read the book today.
Yeah, I've laughed. Believe me, Neil, I have laughed many times in retrospect. But the fact that the Benedictine take a fourth vow, solemn vow, they take the ordinary three solemn vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, but the Benedictines for 1,500 years have taken a fourth vow, the vow of stability, that is, to remain in the same monastery for the rest of their life. So the irony is that God attracted me to a life in a Benedictine monastery in which I took the vow of stability, and then from that time on, my life has been anything but stable. That is ironic.
That is ironic, and the fact that you were a working architect in Houston, then you became a Benedictine monk, and then prior to being ordained to the priesthood, you had a falling out with your prior, your abbot, over essentially a building project, right?
Exactly. It was a pet project of the archabbot. He wanted to build dormitories for St. Vincent College, which would have cost in excess of $1 million. It was a huge sum of money for the monastery to expend, and a lot depended since Benedictines build for the ages. They don't build for decades. They try to build buildings that will last 100, 200, 300 years or more. And so when he presented plans that were really inferior, using inferior materials and building methods, my heart was really turned cold. Because I knew that eventually his project would have to come before the monastic chapter for approval. And as a member of the monastic chapter, I knew that sooner or later at the meeting, someone would demand that I express an opinion. And I knew that if I expressed my honest opinion, which of course I would have to do, honestly, I would jeopardize my ordination, which was just 6 months away. Ordination to the priesthood. I was already an ordained transitional deacon in the Benedictines. And in 6 months, I was scheduled to be ordained to the priesthood as a Benedictine. But I knew that if I expressed my honest opinion about the archabbot's plan for the dormitories, it would be a moment of truth for me, and it was not likely to be very enjoyable.
And it turned out to be very unenjoyable.
That's exactly what happened.
Well, he basically, once you expressed your opinion and his plans were defeated, you got a message to come see him where he basically said, forget about being a priest.
Those were his exact words. I can quote you his exact words. They are cast in bronze in my memory. He said simply, he didn't even greet me. I walked into his office, and he was sitting behind his desk, and he looked up at me, and he said, Frater René, that was my title at the time as a deacon, Frater René, you can forget about being ordained a priest. That was it. That was it. No introduction and no explanation. Those words were all he said, and then he dismissed me.
You must have felt like a huge boulder just fallen on your head.
Well, the only thing I said to him was, by the grace of God, I managed to blurt out these words. I said, for the archabbot, there is no proportionality between the priesthood of our Lord Jesus Christ and your dormitories.
How did you get the word proportionality out of your mouth at a moment like that?
The Holy Spirit. I would normally have never used it, but must have given it to me.
By the way, I want to tell our listeners that as I read your book, and this is only the first of many very serious conflicts that Bishop Gracida faced and still faces, I probably. There was never any rancor and never any anger. There was no tone of anger. It was just basically telling the story And but on the other hand, you didn't seem to leave out anything that would have that if you had left out might have softened the story some. I mean, you told the full story, it seems.
Well, that's true. I did not add anything to the historical event, nor did I leave out anything that took place or was said. That was it. It was that simple and that short, that brief. After I said what I said about the proportionality between priesthood and donators, his next words were simply, "That is all."
And but this arch abbot eventually said, "Just get out of the order," right?
Well, yes, I was ordained, as I say in the book, by God's grace. About a month or so after this event, two abbots came on the triennial visitation of the abbey. And naturally, every monk has a right to speak to the abbot's visitators.
Right.
So when it was my turn to speak with them, I told them the story of what happened. They were appalled, and they reassured me and said, "Don't worry, Father. We will speak to Archabbot Dennis, and you will be ordained." And that's what happened. They spoke to him. He issued what is called a dimissorial letter so that I, along with the other 11 members of my class, were ordained by Bishop Hugh Lamb in Greensburg Cathedral in Pennsylvania. And so everything went along smoothly, in a sense, for the next year and a half, except that he would not speak with me. He would not greet me. He would not look at me. I didn't exist as far as he was concerned. And for a monk to live in a monastery where the archabbot or the abbot who takes the place of Christ in his life totally ignores him, that is intolerable.
It's and very painful.
There is
too,
no peace of soul for the monk in that situation. So that was my situation. So I applied to another monastery against my vow's fidelity, and asked the abbot of the other monastery if he would accept me as a transfer from St. Vincent to Holy Cross Abbey in Colorado. The abbot wrote back immediately and said, "Yes, gladly, come." Well, of course, as I say in the book, I needed the permission not only of the abbot of the monastery I would go to, but the permission of the abbot of the monastery I was leaving, and in addition, a third permission from the president of the Confederation of Abbeys. Well, Archabbot Dennis was also president of the Confederation. So when I went to him and asked if I could transfer, he said, "Absolutely not." So then I asked him, "Well, what do you want of me? It's obvious you do not want me in this monastery. So what do you want?" And then he said quite simply, "I want you to leave the order." Well, for me and my vow of obedience, that was practically an order to leave the order.
Right.
So I felt I had no choice but to do what he said. So I did apply to Rome for a dispensation from my solemn vows. The dispensation was granted. And so on August the 15th, 1961, I took off my habit, my religious habit, and left the monastery and became a diocesan priest in Miami.
By the way, I must comment that your physical appearance as a priest in Miami, you pretty much looked like a movie star in those days.
Oh, come on.
You did. You kind of looked like you could probably dance and sing. And
well,
did you ever?
I did share dancing before I entered the monastery.
Oh, you gave that up? Okay.
Yes, I did.
Well, you certainly were a handsome guy, and you became a kind of, I would call, a all-around utility player for the Archdiocese of Miami. You seemed to go everywhere there was a problem.
Yes, I came to suspect that because I was at that point 37 years old. I was 10 years delayed in my vocation. I was ordained at 36, and normally a man is ordained at 24 or 25. So I was 10 years behind time in my ordination to the priesthood as a Benedictine. So when I went to Miami a year later in 1961, I was 37, I guess, and he saw in me as an older priest, 37 years old, someone who could withstand the shock of being sent into situations that were unholy, unreasonable, untenable. So he began to use me to solve his problems. And as you read in the book, I was transferred into 13 parishes in 16 years.
Yes.
It was a living hell.
You must have developed a very thick skin, Bishop.
I was living out of a suitcase. I had no stability, and for a man who really valued his vow of stability as a Benedictine to now be uprooted every 6 to 18 months and transferred from one parish to the next parish, it was a living hell. But when I was dispensed from my vow of obedience, I swore to God that even though I was no longer formally bound by a solemn vow of obedience, I would live the rest of my life in obedience to legitimate authority. So Archabishop Dennis violated that when he ordered me out of the monastery, but I transferred my obedience to Archbishop Coleman Carroll. And so whatever he asked of me, if it was not immoral, I did it without resistance. I questioned it in my own mind. But I did it without complaint and without resistance. As you read in the book, there was only one time when I questioned his decision to transfer me from one parish to another. And on that occasion, he was transferring me to a parish where the priest had resigned from the pastorate, resigned from the priesthood, and resigned from the Catholic Church because I had told him that he could not build his building with the architect who had designed an extremely expensive building. When the bids came in, it was impossible. So I told him to find a new architect, and then he left. So then the archbishop told me that I was to go there as pastor. Well, you can imagine my chagrin. I told him, the words I used were, but Archbishop, those people will lynch me. They will blame me for the defection of their pastor. And then he said to me after a few moments, he told me the story by himself in Cardinal Bishop Dearden in Pittsburgh. He said simply, "You don't understand. I'm not asking you. I'm telling you."
Yeah.
And so at that point, my vow of obedience kicked in, and I said to him, "I'll not say another word, Archbishop. I will go." And that's exactly what I did.
I'm talking with Bishop Rene Gracida, who you may know as the former Bishop of Corpus Christi, and as he says several times in his books, he earned the reputation for being, quote-unquote, a conservative priest. And, by the way, his conservatism seemed to rankle other bishops who we think of as conservative as well, as such as Cardinal O'Connor and Cardinal Law and others. I was very, very disturbed. I think the only time I was really disturbed was when you had gone to Corpus Christi and you decided that you needed to excommunicate three politicians. And you came back to your fellow bishops in a committee, I guess, at the bishops' conference, and asked them, or you read your decision and why, and there was complete silence in the room.
Yes, it was a stunning moment for me because it was a meeting of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on pro-life activities. The chairman of the committee was Cardinal O'Connor.
Yes.
And so after we finished the day's agenda, I asked the Cardinal, I said, "If we're finished with the business, of the day. May I say a few words about the three excommunications that occurred recently in Corpus Christi? And he said, yes. So then for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I explained what led up to and the process that I followed in excommunicating the three abortionists, the directors of the one doctor and the two directors of the two abortion clinics. And when I had finished, I said, are there any questions? I'll be glad to answer. There was total silence, and we sat there for what seemed like an eternity and in absolute silence. The Cardinal, O'Connor, two other cardinals, Wall was one, as I remember. I think Mahoney was the other one. And then there were four of the bishops and several lay people. And all of those people just sat there and looked at me as though I was an idiot.
Well, Bishop, did any of them come up and sort of pat you on the back afterward privately?
Not at all, on the contrary. I was avoided. I was shunned.
Whoa. Sort of like you were by your prior as a Benedictine.
Exactly. Exactly. Again, you know, I found that people who were in authority disapproved of me and my actions, my words. So it was...
But yet Cardinal Connor would, later on in his own ministry in New York City, he would talk about clearly or threaten excommunication himself, did he not?
I don't understand your question.
I mean, Cardinal O'Connor would eventually threaten excommunication to some of the politicians in his diocese later on.
I read that in the news, but I don't. He never spoke to me about it. And
well, he never did it. I mean, he never actually did it.
Yeah.
In fact, in my research, I think you are only one of two bishops who's done it, the other being Cardinal Burke when he was in Wisconsin.
Well, I didn't know that about Cardinal Burke.
Well, I make it my business to know about, you know, excommunicated politicians.
Incidentally, speaking of Cardinal Burke, let me interject this. When Bishop of Austin, John McCarthy, was slandering me in the public press and the media about the way I was acting as president of the Kennedy Foundation, When he said that I was abusing my authority as president of the Kennedy Foundation to the media, and they printed it, I appealed to John Cardinal O'Connor to muzzle Bishop as best he could. I said, isn't there something you can do to shut him up? I said, this is scandalous that he's criticizing another bishop, a fellow bishop in Texas, about something like the Kennedy Foundation. O'Connor got himself appointed by Cardinal Dantin of the Congregation for Bishops as chairman of the three-bishop investigating committee to investigate the so-called problem in Texas. So he came to Texas, and he and the other two bishops held a meeting in Dallas at which all of the bishops of Texas were forced to attend. And all that occurred at the meeting was that each of us expressed our opinion about what was going on. And the three bishops listened patiently to what each bishop had to say and then adjourned the meeting and left. One of the three bishops, and this is my point, one of the three bishops was Raymond Burke of Wisconsin. Years later, and then that's the last I ever saw of him. I had unfortunately further dealings with O'Connor and Law, but I never saw or heard of or from Raymond Burke. So years later, when I saw him, when I ran into him, I said, by the way, Bishop, Cardinal, by then Cardinal, by the way, Cardinal, whatever happened to you on the Papal Commission to investigate the problem in Texas? He said, Renee, you'll never believe this, but after that meeting in Dallas, O'Connor dropped me from the commission, and I was never given a chance to participate again.
Okay, now hold on. We're going to take a break. My jaw has dropped, and I need to kind of take a moment to push it back up, connect it with my upper jaw. I've been talking with Bishop Rene Grasita about his life, his autobiography, which we'll talk about again after this break. Please stay with us.
The following is a message brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan.
God the Father sent his only Son Jesus for our redemption, and he shares the Holy Spirit as his gift of love. This reveals that he is not alone, but rather one whose very nature is communal and social. Because we are made in God's image and likeness, we share this same social nature, giving us the power and strength to build relationships of faith and love. As Paul states in Romans, I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. As we continue on our faith journey and spread the good word of the Lord, may we make every effort to do what leads us to love and to encourage one another, so that when Jesus comes again, we can all receive the ultimate blessing, eternal life in heaven. This message is brought to you by the Catholic Biblical School of Michigan. You can find us on Facebook or at cbsmich.org.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts, questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
On the next Christ is the Answer program, Father John Ricardo draws near the end of our RCA for Catholics catechetical series and our sub-series on the sacraments of the Church. He discusses the sacrament of marriage. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday evenings at 7, and Sunday mornings at 11 on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
I'm back with Bishop Rene Grosseda, who has published an autobiography entitled An Ordinary's Not-So-Ordinary Life, an autobiography of Rene Henry Grosseda, formerly Bishop of Corpus Christi and very well known throughout the country and in Europe as a strong pro-life bishop. But we found out in the book that he was disappointed by, at least he was disappointed personally in the actions of some other bishops known to be strongly pro-life, such as Cardinal O'Connor. Now, Bishop, you talked a little bit about your conflict as chairman of the board of the Kennedy Foundation. Now, I believe that's the foundation that publishes the Kennedy Directory. Isn't that correct?
No, that's not true. The Kennedy Directory is a New York Corporation publishing house and has nothing to do with the John G. and Marie Stella Kennedy Memorial Foundation.
Well, thanks for telling me that. The reason I thought so is that the unusual spelling of Kennedy is the same. So tell us about the Kennedy Foundation, this very multi-million dollar foundation that you found yourself as Bishop of Corpus Christi very much in charge of.
Well, it's really a very long story, but I'll try and very briefly encapsulate it for the point that you're making. First of all, the foundation was established by Sarita Kennedy East, who died in 1961, and in her will, she established the foundation to be guided by three people. Her nephew, who was the county judge in the county where she lived, her sister-in-law, who lived to be 91 years old and died about 1984. And the third person was ex officio, always to be the Bishop of Corpus Christi. So my predecessor, Bishop Thomas Drury, was, for all of his term as bishop, he was a member of the Kennedy Foundation, And in those years, the foundation board, consisting of the four members, also constituted the board of directors. In 1984, when I became bishop of the diocese, I automatically became a member of the foundation. I became one of the four. One of the four was the president of the Alice National Bank in Alice, Texas, and who controlled the foundation because he was also the banker for one of the other members of the foundation, the sister-in-law of Sarita. She had effective control of the foundation, and all of the liquid assets of the foundation were held by the bank in Alice. In 20 years, the foundation never made a grant. Imagine that.
Well, they must have had an immense amount of money stored up.
$20 million in treasury bills and notes, which the bank charged the foundation for safekeeping. Can you imagine that? Well, anyway, I became president. I became a member. And when one of them died, and so I used what leverage I had to replace one of the other members who was a lawyer, a Protestant lawyer, and I replaced him with four Catholics and one Methodist and one Jew, a Jewish doctor. And so the six of us became the members of the foundation. They elected me president. So then I proceeded for 14 years to be president of the Kennedy Foundation. And we, in turn, elected five other people. And so we ended up with an 11-person board of directors. Well, the foundation did a lot of good. The IRS required us in 1984 to make the first grants in 20 years. After I had gotten back the $20 million from the bank, transferred it to a bank in Corpus Christi, with that money we began to make grants. And we distributed all $20 million in grants to hospitals, universities, other institutions here in South Texas.
Well, what I don't understand, Bishop, is here you took over a foundation that hadn't made any grants for 20 years. You revived it. You started doing good works with it. And yet the other bishops of Texas would eventually accuse you of abusing your power at a foundation that they had nothing to do with.
Well, within a few years, we had built up the portfolio of the foundation to about $300 million. And with the income from that portfolio, plus the income from oil and gas, plus the income from leasing out the ranch for grazing and hunting, from all of that income, we were able to give the other dioceses of Texas, during those 14 years, over $20 million in grants.
But you omitted Houston and Dallas when you did that.
What?
You didn't give any money to Houston and Dallas.
I'm still don't understand.
Okay, you did not give any money to the Diocese of Houston and Dallas, correct?
That is correct. Dallas had several Catholic foundations. Houston had several Catholic foundations. The Kennedy Foundation was the only Catholic foundation in Southwest Texas.
Yes.
And therefore, we felt that it was wrong to send money to Dallas and Houston. So those were the only two dioceses that we did not give money to because they were rich. They didn't need our money. But to all of the other dioceses of Texas, we gave over $20 million. But it wasn't enough. Bishop McCarthy and Bishop McCleason wanted it all. They wanted the whole thing. They wanted to displace me from the foundation. And so that's what started the whole problem. You know, they went public, and then they went to the Attorney General, and they persuaded the Attorney General of Texas to file a lawsuit against me.
I still don't understand there's no justice in that. I mean, you brought this foundation back from the dead. You were distributing millions of dollars to diocese around Texas, and obviously your own diocese and needs down in South Texas. How could they, in their own minds, justify coming after you about something that they didn't have anything to do with in the first place?
Well, only God knows the answer to that question, but I can explain probably my guess in terms of human processes. They overlooked the grants that we gave, and they focused on the grants that we turned down. In their mind, no grants from them should have been turned down.
That's where the edge came. They were asking for money, and you weren't giving it to them.
They were not grateful for the $20 million of grants that we gave them, but instead they focused upon the few hundred thousand dollars of grants that we refused to grant. And so they accused me of abusing my power.
And I'm still puzzled by why a Texas court judge would find you somehow guilty of not running the foundation correctly. I mean, what?
Well, no, that never happened.
What did he do in relation to the foundation?
No, let me correct you, Deal.
Sure.
The case, the lawsuit brought by the Attorney General never went to court.
Okay.
It never went to court. Cardinal O'Connor proposed to the Attorney General of Texas the solution of having the foundation board replaced by the bishops of Texas. That was his solution. Okay?
Yes.
We resisted it, and we said no. And so we proposed expanding the board of directors to 13 and including two more bishops. So there would be three bishops out of 13, but the majority, the other 10 people, would all be lay people. Because the board wanted the foundation to remain in lay control, not bishop control. So we proposed that. O'Connor refused, but the Attorney General accepted that solution. And so the Attorney General settled the case out of court, in which he accepted the board's solution of expanding the board to 13 members.
But eventually this dispute ended up in Rome, and I think you said that this was really disastrous for you.
Well, it didn't end up in Rome. No, this time it did not end up in Rome. On previous occasions, when Brother Leo was trying to get control of the foundation back in the 60s, and he enlisted the help of Peter Grace in New York, Peter Grace enlisted the help of Cardinal Spellman, and Cardinal Spellman tried to take over the foundation and went to Rome to get Rome's help in taking over the foundation. They failed. Okay, the court, that did go to trial, and the judge ruled against them and established the foundation as it is today. And then later on, Peter Grace turned to Cardinal Kroll for help, and Cardinal Kroll tried to take over the foundation. And again, Cardinal Kroll went to Rome, and with Rome's help, tried to take over the foundation. And again, they were thwarted by Texas court system, and the foundation remained in South Texas. So then finally along comes Cardinal O'Connor, again trying to take over the foundation with Rome's help. And again, the Attorney General and the court in Austin accepted the settlement that we proposed, and the case was dropped. So it never went to Rome for decision, and it never went to court for decision during my time.
So were you able to remain in charge during all this period, and for how long?
Yes, but of course, the final solution came in my 74th year. And so it was time for me to submit my letter of resignation on my 75th birthday, which is required by canon law. And so I did, and it was immediately accepted.
Let's switch gears a little bit, because we've been talking about, again, what is, you know, very interesting part of your book, An Ordinary's Not-So-Ordinary Life, about the conflict that you faced. During your years in Corpus Christi, exactly how many years were you? Did you serve as bishop in Corpus Christi?
I was bishop from 1983 until 1997, a period of 14 years.
What was the most delightful part of your ministry in Corpus Christi? Of course, I'm a native Texan, as you know, and have a lot of friends and family all over Texas. But what was it that, you know, you remember with the most fondness?
Well, I would have to be dishonest if I didn't tell you that being the president of a foundation with assets of almost half a billion dollars was pleasurable.
You were able to help a lot of people and plus get things done in your own diocese.
We gave away hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so naturally, I mean, when you play Santa Claus with other people's money, you know, it's a pleasurable thing.
Yeah, it does give you a lot of, it gave, you know, Aristotle says that magnanimity is a virtue that's only, can only be practiced by the wealthy because they have the wherewithal to be magnanimous.
Right.
So can you, I think that you can say that you had that virtue.
Well, yes, even though it wasn't my money, you know, it belonged to the foundation, I derived a great deal of satisfaction in guiding the foundation over a period of 14 years, during which the board of directors of the foundation gave away several hundred million dollars in grants.
And you were obviously able to do a great deal in Corpus Christi with that money.
Yes, when I became president and we started making grants, I called a meeting of my consultors, the 12 priests of the diocese, and I said to them, all right, the Kenneth Foundation is now going to start making grants. This diocese has been starving financially now for many, many years. And so money is going to become available. I don't want to spend money foolishly. So I want you to tell me what is the greatest priority that you see for the Diocese of Corpus Christi. So I gave them a sheet of paper, and I said, list 25 projects that you can envision in the order of importance. Number them, 1, 2, 3, 4, et cetera, as them being important. So when I gathered the 12 sheets of paper and we tallied up the results, we found that the number one priority of virtually every priest and soldier was religious education facility, since most of the parishes and missions in the diocese did not have proper classrooms in which to teach religious education. So, since most of the parishes didn't have schools, so they were holding CCD classes under the trees, in the church, in the rectory, anywhere they could find shelter. So, the first few years, we built religious education facilities, and I'm talking about really nice 8-classroom facilities in every parish and mission in the diocese. That, for me, was if God grants me a place in the Book of Life, you know, to give me credit, I hope that one of the things that is written down there, that I gave religious education the highest priority for the spending of money for the first 5 years of the Kennedy Foundation's giving it grants.
Now, I assume that the buildings you built are still standing tall because you had that.
That's another thing. I was criticized by some of my enemies because I did not build monuments. Even though I was an architect, they expected me, once the Kennedy Foundation started giving money away, they expected me to build monuments to myself. I did not. On the contrary, I built classroom buildings that were strictly utilitarian. They were built to last, but they were not built to be admired as monuments.
But I assume you built them to last a long time.
Yes.
And did you get criticized for, you probably ended up putting more money into those buildings than normally would be put into them?
No, that's the irony. Mm-hmm. Wasn't criticized for not building them better, since they were well built. I was criticized for not building beautiful buildings, beautiful in the sense of monuments.
Now, why is it that you didn't attempt to make your buildings more beautiful? Because certainly when I read about, for example, your work on St. Malachy's in New York City, where you, all the work you did in building a new altar there and stabilizing the floor and so forth, you obviously had very good taste in design and architecture.
Well, people don't believe me, but it was a forced act of humility in which I forswore, I gave up, I renounced my right as an architect bishop to build beautiful buildings. I said, I will never let people in the future criticize me for having, as an architect bishop, built beautiful buildings that cost a lot of money. Instead, I built functional, practical buildings that met the purpose for which they were designed, but which could not be referred to as one of the bishop received as monuments.
Does that mean you turned Bauhaus when you went to Corpus Christi?
Well, I always was something of a Bauhaus bishop architect. it didn't take much effort on my part to go lean and mean rather than decorative and very Mozart, you know.
Well, you know, I want to get to what I think is the toughest question for me to ask. I don't think it's a tough question for you, but I know that over the years that I've known you, appreciated your work and spoken to you and watched you, and you've written for me at Crisis Magazine and so forth, it was clear that your high profile as a pro-life bishop was not appreciated by a lot of the bishops, and certainly not by the bishops' conference. How much did it cost you personally to take that position and stick by it for your entire career as a bishop?
Well, it cost me a lot, Gil. It cost me a lot because, aside from the absolute silence on the part of all bishops in the United States on the subject of the three excommunications, no bishop has ever spoken to me about those excommunications. No bishop has ever spoken to me about the three excommunications. That, to me, hurts. I would have expected at least one of my brother bishops to say to me, Bishop Rene, I don't understand why you did it. I don't understand how you did it, but I admire your courage in doing it. But no one ever said that to me.
You would think that they would say at least that.
What?
That you would think they would say at least that.
Yes, well, I expected them to say at least that. That's the very minimum, that fraternal bond of being a brother bishop required. But no bishop has ever, ever spoken to me about the three excommunications in Corpus Christi. And that hurts.
Well, I know, Bishop, when I went looking for information on it, it was very hard to find. I mean, I did find it, and I did get the facts on it, but there wasn't a lot of information out there publicly about those excommunications.
The irony is that I was interviewed by media in Europe and even in Australia. Australian television sent a crew all the way from Australia to Corpus Christi to interview me on camera. Now, that, by contrast, shows up the American bishop so much that, you know, it's astounding. Speechless and speechless. That I was getting calls from France and from Belgium and from Holland asking me about the excommunications. I was getting calls from Australia, yet no one in the United States that's connected with the church ever called me.
Well, I could tell stories about calls I didn't get either at certain moments in my life.
Of course.
But, we won't go into that.
I know your history.
Yeah. And I've always felt your support for everything I've done. And I think all pro-life apostolates and leaders have felt that from you. And we want to thank you. I'm going to thank you for myself and for them right now. Thank you, Bishop.
Thank you, Dio.
And I hope people will read your book. I think anybody that wants to know what it's like on the inside of the life of a courageous pro-life bishop like Rene Gracida should read this book, An Ordinary's Not-So-Ordinary Life, the autobiography of the Most Reverend Bishop Rene Henry Gracida. Bishop Gracida, thank you for being a guest on Church and Culture, and will you come back and talk some more?
Yes, I will, Dale. Thank you, Dale. God love you. God bless you.
And to all of you listening, please come back this time and this day next week for some other very interesting guests.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, as we approach the season of giftedness, the Eastern Catholic Churches are grateful for a gift from Pope Francis that will contribute towards ecumenical relationships.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO Ave Maria Radio.
At their September 2011 meeting, the Ladies of Heart to Heart Catholic Women's Apostolate hosted Father Ben Lucky talking about forgiveness.
No one can heal that wound but you. And so we have to recognize that it is our obligation to forgive so that we can heal that wound. During the Mass I said that we can forgive over and over and over until the wound is healed. Well, that's exactly what we have to do, especially when we're disappointed in someone.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. On his annual visit to Heart to Heart, Father Ben Lucky taught about our obligation to forgive so that we are able to receive the Lord's healing, and how the sacrament of confession plays a key role in that healing process. Listen to Putting On the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Studying poetry doesn't have to be a chore. Today on Homeschool Heartbeat, homeschooling mom Kathy Weitz shares some fun and easy ways to learn and appreciate poetry.
Kathy, we've already discussed the value of teaching poetry, and I'm sure our listeners are eager to add this important component to their children's education. But for most parents listening, their own experience with poetry is very limited. In fact, they may